Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers. Additional KCRW programs and podcasts are available at kcrw.com.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Dubai, port security, and ethnic stereotyping. Hello again, I'm Norman Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Dubai Ports World won't take over terminals at six American ports till the Bush administration has tried a selling job on the Congress. The president himself says to treat Dubai differently from other countries would send a disastrous message to the Middle East. On To the Point, with foreign companies already running most American ports, what is the Arab reaction to the outcry over Dubai? Is America's political crisis fueled by a real threat or stereotypes formed since September 11th? What does it mean for Arab Americans? On Reporter's Notebook later on, Mardi Gras after Katrina. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Norman Olney, back with To the Point. President Bush is standing his ground on Dubai's control of American port terminals, but many Republicans as well as Democrats are adamantly opposed. On To the Point, is it a real threat to security or a political crisis fueled by negative stereotypes? What's the reaction in the Arab world and among Arab Americans? On Reporter's Notebook, we'll talk to satirist and part-time New Orleans resident Harry Shearer about the run-up to Mardi Gras. First, this news update. An extraordinary daytime curfew helped establish a degree of calm in Iraq today, but the discovery of 17 bodies killed execution style brought the death toll to nearly 200 since the Shiite Golden Mosque was destroyed 2 days ago. At the White House, President Bush said he had spoken with Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad.
The ambassador reports many religious leaders are committed to a unified Iraq, a peaceful Iraq. The response by the Grand Ayatollah Sistani and many other leaders has been constructive and very important, and we appreciate their leadership.
Borzu Daragahi is in Baghdad for the Los Angeles Times. The president mentioned only one Iraqi leader by name, the Grand Ayatollah Sistani. How important is that?
I think it's very important. I was just noting it to myself that's interesting. That was the only person that he mentioned. That's basically the only person at this point, according to many Iraqis and many observers, who can hold the country back from a further escalation in the civil strife that is now abounding. A vacuum as far as the political authority goes. They don't seem to have much credibility or much power, really, to stop this. It's really the clerics who call the shots now.
I want to get back to that in a moment. But first, what about these 17 people found killed? In what manner were they killed, and what's the significance of that?
Well, actually, it's 29 now. Body count keeps going up. This is part of an ongoing mystery, really, but really no one considers it a mystery. But it's been now almost a year, that you've had this constant supply of bodies showing up, dumped in ditches all over Baghdad and certain provinces. And they were all, in this case, shot in the head and handcuffed. And many people suspect that these are victims of Shiite death squads, possibly with ties to the Interior Ministry, who do a little after-hours work, if you will, going around and picking up suspected insurgents, people they don't like, people they have scores to settle with, and taking care of them in an extrajudicial fashion.
Talking to Borzu Daragahi with the Los Angeles Times in Baghdad, well, isn't there some inconsistency on the part of the Ayatollah Sistani? On the one hand, he's calling for peace and calm. On the other hand, he's suggesting that perhaps the civilian militias, if they are in fact civilian, ought to be doing more to keep the peace. Does that suggest that he's advocating death squads?
But I mean, it's really interesting because I've been kind of just analyzing the comments of the clerics during the Friday prayer sermons today and in previous weeks, and more so than ever, you have this you know, this kind of game they play, and I'm not sure what they're doing, and I think it's not contributing to helping the problem. But they'll say, in one sentence, they'll say, we really denounce the violence, and, you know, Sunnis and Shiites should love each other, and, you know, by golly, we're going to have unity, and Iraq is one. And then in the very next sentence, they'll say, like, you know, but they started it, and if we defend ourselves, we'll defend ourselves. And you have this sort of rhetorical game that everyone is playing, Sunnis and Shiites. So on the one hand, they do call for peace, but on the other hand, they're kind of talking tough.
And so from the United States point of view, I suppose the glass is half full, but in fact, it may be half empty, too, in terms of the ability to restore order in Iraq.
I think that the Shiite clerics and the Sunni clerics even maybe earlier realized that if they don't sort of capture and reflect the mood of their masses, of their followers, they will lose relevance in their and they will lose power. So they're constantly trying to sort of stay tuned to what's happening with their flock so that they reflect their views.
What about the possibility, then, of ultimately a theocracy in Iraq? Is that what we're looking at?
Not sure if that's what we're looking at. The current constitution doesn't seem to be calling for a theocracy. But what it shows more than anything is, to some extent, like I don't know what some would call, and, you know, there's some U.S. analysts who know Iraq really well, what they would call the bankruptcy of the U.S. policy here and the bankruptcy of the government that they're forming here, mostly consisting of exiles. Very few of the current leaders of Iraq actually have lived in Iraq until after the occupation and after the U.S. came. And so they lack a lot of credibility, and into that vacuum, there go the clerics.
Barzu Daragahi, as always, thanks a lot for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank
you. Staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, based in Baghdad. In a moment, Dubai, port security, and ethnic stereotyping on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Well, we're only back with To the Point. Dubai Ports World has agreed not to take over terminals at six American ports, while the Bush administration tries to sell Congress on a very unpopular deal. The state of New Jersey and the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey are going to court to stop it. Congress may pass legislation as soon as next week, but President Bush still insists he will veto any new law, and he says that treating Dubai as less trustworthy than other countries sends a signal to the Middle East that would be disastrous. We'll go to Dubai itself in a moment, but first, here is Ali Abu Nima. He is a Palestinian-American who monitors media coverage of Middle East issues, and he joins us from Chicago. Welcome to our program.
Hi, Warren.
How does this look from the standpoint of an Arab American?
Well, I have to tell you honestly, Warren, it's been chilling. I just got back from a week in New York, and there I found the way this issue's been talked about in the popular media terrifying. And the discussion rarely or often is simply at the level of the ports are going to be given to the quote-unquote Arabs. The Arabs are our enemies. Therefore, we must stop it. And it sounds to me a lot like what I've read, the way people were talking about Japanese Americans during World War II, and even in Nazi Germany, people saying the national security of Germany depends on us not letting the quote-unquote Jewish banks and Jewish companies control our economy. And I think the backlash is out of all proportion to the issue. The issue has been grossly misrepresented. And I think this is an indication of an atmosphere in which there is collective guilt being ascribed to Arabs and Muslims generally because of what happened on 9/11.
Not only 9/11, but of course there's also been the recent flap over the cartoons and the people over which people have been killed, perhaps accidentally, but killed nonetheless, and the continuing problem that we see in Iraq. Doesn't all that, do you think, fuel the problem?
Of course it does. And just the other week, Günter Grass, the German novelist, likened the cartoons to things that were being published about Jews in Nazi Germany. That's a pretty strong statement. And of course, yes, this all comes into this atmosphere of fear. But look, we don't ascribe collective guilt to other groups of people the same way. We don't say that all white Christian Americans are likely to be torturers because of what we saw at Abu Ghraib. We say it's a few bad apples. We don't say all white Christian Americans are likely to be terrorists because of Oklahoma City and Tim McVeigh blowing up the federal building, or Christian activists shooting or bombing abortion clinics. We say it's the acts of individuals. Muslims are a third of humanity. We cannot get on in the world if we do not discriminate in the sense of clearly knowing what it is we're against, and not ascribing collective guilt to people simply because of their race and ethnicity. And I have to tell you, to me it becomes conceivable now that if, heaven forbid, there's another attack like 9/11, that next people will be calling for preventing Arab Americans from having certain jobs, perhaps even rounding them up. And what makes it so terrible, Warren, is that I feel this is all very cynical manipulation and fear-mongering by the likes of Hillary Clinton. I think it's no coincidence that the media is so bad about this in New York, and others who will do anything to score points against the Bush administration, I think at the expense of the most basic and fundamental American values.
How do you feel about the position of President Bush?
Well, it's odd because it's maybe the first time I feel that I agree with President Bush about a Middle East-related issue. But I have to say that he, as much as anyone else, has been responsible for fear-mongering, for trying to scare Americans about Muslims. And so I'm not sure he's really off the hook. But at least on the very basics of this issue, I think he has it right.
Ali Abu Nima, again, is a Palestinian-American based in Chicago. We'll come back to him as our program goes on. Phyllis Schlafly is a conservative lawyer, a political analyst, an activist. She is president of the Eagle Forum, which is a conservative group. She is also author most recently of The Supremacist, The Tyranny of Judges and How to Stop It. Ms. Schlafly, welcome to you.
Hello, Warren.
I think it's correct to describe you as a person who generally agrees with President Bush, but not on this one. Why not?
I think he's made a big mistake, and I think it's very unfortunate that the people who support this deal are trying to smear all Americans as though they were bigoted or like Hitler or other unpleasant epithets that have been tossed out by people supporting this deal. The standard is that Americans think that our ports are our property, and we can have whoever we want running them. And I would say there's nothing unusual about opposing a Middle Eastern government from controlling our ports. Many of us were very active in preventing the Chinese from owning the port at Long Beach. And we were very successful on that. We did not think that the government of China should own our port at Long Beach, and we were successful in stopping that. Likewise, we opposed very much the Chinese owning the ports in Panama. We lost that one. But nevertheless, Americans stand up for what we think are our country's best interests, and we're entitled to do it without being smeared as though we're some kind of bigoted hate mongers.
As I understand it, the Chinese do own one of the major terminals at the port of Long Beach, which is right next to the Los Angeles, right next to the port of Long Beach.
But we stopped them in Long Beach.
What about the president's statement that if we treat, first of all, it's my understanding that most of the ports are what are referred to as landlord ports, and that foreign companies do run most of the terminals. I forget what percentage it is, but it's very high, in the neighborhood of 75-80%, something like that. The president says that if we make a distinction with an Arab country that has been very useful in the war on terror, that again according to Secretary Rice, then we're sending a terrible message to the Middle East. How do you respond to that?
Well, in the first place, we're entitled to make a distinction. England has been always been our friend since 1814. And other countries may have governments that come and go with their friendliness toward this country. But the standard is that Americans should make that decision. And it's not somebody's right to come in and own our ports. And the problem with President Bush is he doesn't have any credibility on the matter of securing our borders. He's allowed, he apparently believes in open borders, believes in a globalist approach that it's okay for foreigners and other countries to come in and own things. And I noticed that Gary Hart got resurrected on television last night to make his comment, and he said this is the confluence of the age of terrorism with the age of globalism, and we're just going to have to get used to it. But the American people are not willing to accept this notion of open borders, that anybody can come in and enter our country at will or own our property.
Gary Hart, of course, one time Democratic senator from Colorado and part-time or often almost a presidential candidate. Well, Ms. Schlafly, you find yourself on this issue in the same camp, I gather, as Senator Clinton of New York. What are the consequences of that?
Well, that means that President Bush is really fracturing the Republican Party. And he should have checked to find. I think he must be living in some kind of a bubble that he did not realize what a flap this would create. And the idea of President Bush allowing Hillary Clinton and Senator Schumer to get out on the patriotic national security side of this issue and the side of him is extremely hurtful to all Republicans. And it's another way, in addition to his failure to secure our borders, that is alienating large numbers of what should be his constituency.
Phyllis Schlafly with the Eagle Forum. Back to Ali Abu Nima, our Palestinian-American media monitor in Chicago. Ms. Schlafly says that people such as yourself are smearing all Americans. You have suggested that there's stereotyping going on her side. Respond to her suggestion that that you're smearing everybody else.
Well, no, I'm not smearing everyone else. I was referring to specific things I've heard in the media, and I this is the first I hear Ms. Schlafly say anything on the issue, so I'm definitely not making generalizations. But having heard her, I have to say this is exactly the kind of scaremongering I'm talking about, because she's saying that a foreign company is going to take over our ports. That's simply not true. The United States government remains responsible for security at the ports as it was, as it is, and as it will be. What we have is a foreign company that operates the ports that is being transferred in ownership to another foreign country. There's no responsibility for security taking place. And the fact that Ms. Schlafly has no objection to a foreign-owned company operating the ports as long as it's not an Arab one is exactly what I'm talking about. And there are people claiming that the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, had links to 9/11. Well, Richard Reid, the shoe bomber, was British. That doesn't seem to bother Ms. Schlafly either. So I think we have to be very clear that what we see Hillary Clinton and others doing is preying on the pre-existing fears and general sort of readiness to view Arabs and Muslims as suspicious in a way that we don't treat other people, and using that to make political points. I think it's very unfortunate. I think we need to reflect on where our country is going. Things like putting Japanese Americans in concentration camps as we did during World War II, we like to flatter ourselves that that's all in the past. But I think if we don't take a good, hard look at where we're going, we could end up there again.
Ms. Schlafly, do you understand the concerns of Ali Abu Nima?
No, I think he's paranoid, and he's trying to smear us all. Now, if he can't understand the difference between a British citizen who was a shoe bomber and the British government, and the fact that the people who want to control our court from the Arab Emirates is a government-owned and dominated country.
Well, wait a minute, though. What's the difference between, or isn't there a difference between somebody who might have terrorist inclinations and be involved with the or citizen of the United Arab Emirates and the government of Dubai?
Well, but it's a government-owned company. There's a big difference between a government-owned company and a private company.
Well, but is the government, anyway, the government of Dubai...
We are entitled to make a difference between the government of England and the government of Dubai.
Well, is the government of Dubai suspect? Do you want to make that distinction? Because it's Arab.
We're entitled to make that distinction because it's ours. That is absolutely right.
No, I'm sorry. I'm asking, are you saying you're making the distinction because Dubai is Arab?
I'm making the distinction because it is a government-owned company and which has a number of shady things in its past, like a couple of the 9/11 criminals and laundering money through it, yes. And I know they're trying to get along with them now. We get along with a lot of dictatorships around the country, but that doesn't mean we want to allow them to control our ports. And the Bush administration failed to insist on a lot of things that would should have been necessary to it, such as requiring that they keep their records on American soil, that they have an American who can go through the records. We understand that only between 2% and 5% of the containers are inspected, and we don't know what's in the others. And again, we get back to the fact that Bush's position is trust me. And many of us believe with Ronald Reagan that it should be trust but verify. And unfortunately, Bush does not have a good record of being trustworthy on the matter of securing our borders.
Ali Abunima, we just have a minute before we need to go to a break, but do you understand the kinds of concerns that Ms. Schlafly just enumerated?
Well, again, she's misrepresenting the issue. She keeps saying that a foreign government is going to take over our ports. That's simply not true. The U.S. government remains, is, and will remain in charge of security at U.S. ports. Ms. Schlafly, you know, if Americans really knew the amount of foreign capital on which our economy relies, they would understand completely just what demagoguery it is she's saying. Our entire economy, the jobs we have, the wealth we have, depends on foreign investment in this country. And to single it out because Arabs are involved or Muslims are involved is sending the worst possible message after Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, the war in Iraq, and everything else that's going on. It's the last thing we need to do.
Ms. Schlafly, I'm going to interrupt in the interest of time. Ms. Schlafly, 30 seconds before we go to the break. We'll come back to both of you after that, but just a quick response, if you will.
Well, just because Belgium owns some supermarkets and Japan owns some of Hollywood, that is not the same thing as having a stake in our ports, which is the entry of possible terrorist attacks.
All right. Phyllis Schlafly, once again, president of the Eagle Forum. Ali Abunima, Palestinian-American in Chicago, student of media coverage in this country. We will be back to talk to both of them and others as well, including people in both Dubai and Lebanon. On Reporter's Notebook, we'll talk to Harry Shearer, satirist and part-time resident of New Orleans, about the run-up to Mardi Gras. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
We're only back with To the Point, talking today about the deal by which the company owned by Dubai, the state of Dubai and the United Arab Emirates, is scheduled to take over the operation of terminals at some ports in the United States. We've been talking with Ali Abunima and Phyllis Schlafly. We'll come back to both of them in a moment. And we'll also talk to Rami Khoury, who's editor-at-large of the Daily Star in Beirut. He's been listening to this conversation all along. But first, we've just been joined by Afshin Ratansi. He is a journalist who's worked for the BBC and CNN and Al Jazeera, all of those places. He most recently spent 2 years in Dubai launching a 24-hour business news station for the United Arab Emirates government. He's also a novelist, author of The Dream of the Decade. I said he was in Dubai. He is not at the moment. He is in London. Afshin Ratansi, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi there.
Now, let me ask you this question. Would Dubai allow an American company to control terminals there?
I think that's a crucial question. Aside from the obvious criticisms made in the States saying this is racism, in fact, even the U.S. president seemed to be suggesting it was racism, the uproar over these ports, it has to be said that I think very few countries in the developing world would allow a state to control their port facilities. However, one could also say that Dubai has a lot of its military infrastructure, has deep harbors, which are used by U.S. Military. In fact, it was those deep harbors that Dubai allowed the Americans to use to attack Afghanistan and Iraq from. I think that's a very good question. I don't think any Arab government would look too good right now to its people if it allowed the United States to control one of its ports.
What about the reaction in the Arab world to this dispute that's going on here in this country?
I think the entire Arab press is pretty united in remarks that reflect one of your correspondents in the studio there, in that this is a clear xenophobia. The Chinese, after all, prop up the U.S. dollar. And there are massive investments, massive Arab investments in U.S. infrastructure. When the Saudi Arabian prince, Al-Waleed Talal, bailed out Citigroup now, when it went bust in the 80s, I don't think there was much outcry. Of course, I understand that ports have a certain strategic significance, perhaps even greater than banking.
So you're coming down on both sides here, it seems to me. On the one hand, you're saying that there has been a lot of xenophobia in the United States, but on the other hand, there's plenty of xenophobia in the Arab world as well.
Well, it's not so much xenophobia in the Arab world. I think it's the fact that any country... in fact, it comes down to economic models, doesn't it? Because the United States believes in this free market, no holds bars, in theory anyway, idea of free market capitalism. And part and parcel of that is giving away management of these six major ports in the United States away because that's the free market. Other countries do not have that belief in the free market. Other countries believe that it is of strategic importance to have control, even of the management, regardless of whether the White House, as it says at the moment, says that U.S. Customs will be controlling security at these ports.
Regardless, though, of whether there's an economic difference or a philosophical difference, wouldn't it also be pretty unpopular in the Arab world if American companies were allowed to take control of a facility so strategic and important as a port?
I think it's very interesting that when I was in Dubai launching the station, Dubai, one must understand, 80% are expatriate workers from the subcontinent, from India. There's about 20% Arab nationals from Dubai, from the Gulf. They are obviously hugely impacted upon by the invasion of Iraq, the situation vis-a-vis Palestine and Israel in the Middle East. There's always this fear. I mean, today we heard that the Saudi Arabia government announced that they'd foiled a plan to destroy a refinery. Within this context, regardless of whether they would allow the United States to take a port, and I don't think populations would accept that, I do remember Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, the ruler of Dubai, saying quite clearly over a dispute of islands with Iran, I must remember one can probably water ski to Iran from Dubai, Sheikh Mohammed said the Americans are deliberately trying to create differences between Dubai and Iran, whereas Dubai has always tried to be close with all of its neighbors because it's of strategic use to be friendly with all its neighbors, even whilst they're so close to the United States politically.
Afshin Ratansi, again, a journalist and author. I understand you also are a Muslim, but you are not an Arab. Is that correct?
That's right.
An important distinction in this conversation.
Yes, actually a Shia Muslim.
Okay.
In The Dream of the Decade, available on Amazon.com, I talk about the fear of militancy and the fear of terrorism. And I think certainly the White House is using that argument that you mustn't allow them, you're allowing the militants to win if you overturn deals that you would do with any other non-Arab country.
Again, Afshin Ratansi is in London. We'll come back to him, as we will to Ali Abu Nima and Phyllis Schlafly as well. But first, as promised, Irami Khoury is with us and, again, has been listening patiently throughout this program. Editor-at-large, The Daily Star, a Beirut-based English-language newspaper that is distributed throughout the Arab world. It's always good to have you on our program, and thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me again.
Can you make a generalization about the Arab world and the way it's responding to what's happening here in this country? How important is it? President Bush says it would be disastrous if, in fact, the United States appeared to be handling Dubai differently from other countries.
Well, I think generally we can characterize American foreign policy in the Middle East broadly as already being disastrous in the eyes of most people in the Arab world, I would say. So this is seen by most people as really just being another poke in the eye in a context of several really offensive and, in the eyes of many people in the Arab world, I think neocolonial and even racist American attitudes to the people in the Arab and the Islamic countries. There's extreme anger and indignation, and people are taking deep offense at the way that this case is being handled. Precisely at a moment when the United States is selling, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars of its treasury debt every year to foreign countries, including many Arab countries, when it is promoting free trade, when it is promoting globalization, when already about a quarter of American ports, I think is the right figure, 26-27% of port facilities already owned by foreign companies, when you have foreign companies already owning even parts of strategic defense industries, sometimes even indirectly, like Magnavox, for instance, is indirectly owned by Philips. You know, there's just this massive contradiction between the way people in this region see the U.S. treating the world and treating the people in the Arab Islamic region. And they really take offense at this. And me being a good Greek Orthodox Christian Arab, I am even more offended because I think the sense is that this is another double standard that is being perpetrated. And it really has nothing to do with security. I mean, Phyllis Schlafly's concerns about security are perfectly legitimate. And I think all of us need to be concerned about security. This is not about security. This is about a hysterical political overreaction and a political ploy within the United States by frantic Democrats who are trying to go to the right of President Bush. And they finally found an issue that they think they can jump on. But this is going to come back and bite the United States so hard, because it's going to tell a lot of people around the world, including Chinese and Arabs and others, who are going to say, wait a minute, if this is how the United States deals with global investment, we don't want anything to do with this. So I think the United States should think through this very carefully, separate legitimate security concerns from incoherent and sort of neo-colonial, quasi-racist responses and from domestic politics. You have to separate those three things together, and I think this is the general sense that people have, the general feeling that people have around the Arab world, I would say.
You said 26% of American port facilities are owned by foreign companies. I've seen much higher numbers than that.
It's in that range, yeah. I've heard figures of 26, 28, that either owned or operated.
Okay.
And so I don't have the exact figure. But the point is, foreign ownership is a different issue than security control. Security is in the hands. You know, British Airways runs a terminal. Air France runs a terminal, probably China Airlines runs a terminal at JFK Airport, I imagine. But security is an American concern and absolutely is a legitimate concern. And I think you have to separate these issues. And if people want to be a little bit over the top in the United States in terms of Arab bashing, if they want to do that, I think they should understand that this is going to worsen the cycle that we've been in since 9/11. And we need to work together to fight terrorism and to bring the Arabs and the Muslims and the Europeans and the Americans and the Chinese closer together based on shared values of the rule of law and good governance and democracy and human rights, not to alienate people with this kind of behavior. So I think, my suggestion to people in the United States who are pushing this issue because they think it's going to give them political gain, is to really think through the consequences of this much more rationally.
Rami Kouri at the Daily Star in Beirut. Phyllis Schlafly, back to you, president of the Eagle Forum. What about the economic consequences, the idea that in this global economy where so many other nations already own American debt very significantly, including the Chinese and many Arab countries as well, that it could be very much against the interests of the United States, come back to bite us, as Rami Kouri said, if we offend too many other countries?
Well, of course, that money started right here in the United States with the money the Americans are using to buy Chinese products and the money that Americans are spending to buy Middle East oil. But I hear those who want the deal to go ahead as saying we should stick to the Bush deal because of this widespread unpleasant reaction from people in the Arab world, and that we should be more sensitive to what their feelings are. And I think we should turn that around the other way and say Dubai ought to pull out of the deal because of the widespread American feelings on this subject and the patriotic feelings of Americans who think that foreign governments should not be in control of our ports. And I think they have to get along in the world with us, and they should be sensitive to our feelings on it. And I also think to any extent that the Arab world is unhappy about this, the Bush administration did mishandle it. There were all kinds of requirements they could have put on the deal, such as requiring the Dubai Ports World to keep copies of its business records on U.S. soil, where they would be subject to orders by American courts. They were not required to designate an American citizen to accommodate requests by our government.
So let me just ask you this. Are you suggesting, then, are there conditions that could be imposed that you'd find acceptable?
Well, no, I'm not suggesting that. I'm just suggesting how it was mishandled, and the reaction is a good bit of the result of the mishandling. The deal should have been scotched in the first place.
All right, I
would like to respond to those who said that this is just the free market, and it is, of course, the view of the Bush administration that we should go with a free market, but that is not generally a popular view in this country. And I think they have to recognize that the Americans have something to say about these.
All right. Obviously, a lot of issues involved here. Rami Kouri, I want to come back to you. You, for whatever reason, there are certainly, and you elicited or enumerated some of the reasons that you think there is great anti-Americanism in the Arab world at the moment. Does that make it, in your estimation, understandable at least, that there would be the kind of reaction there has been in the United States, where people really don't know very much about the way ports are operated or who's actually doing the operating?
Well, I would say it's not that there's anti-Americanism. There's opposition to American foreign policies, but there is also great admiration for many American values and principles. So you'll find the same people who are criticizing a certain part of Bush's foreign policy trying to get a visa to send their kids to study in the United States. So I think there's a very clear distinction in people's minds here, what we like about America and what we don't like. And what we don't like are sort of self-serving, expedient, double standards and hypocritical domestic political policies. The Arabs are the last people that you can kick around in the United States. There is no other group in the United States that can be maligned, as Ali Abu Namik correctly said. The Arabs are easy targets in this respect. And obviously this has been aggravated since 9/11. There is a real problem with terrorism in the world, and the Arabs have suffered from it a lot. So people are reacting to what they see as a double standard, as an inappropriate policy, as hypocrisy. And what we desperately have been trying to do for years and years is ask the Americans to simply be American, you know, practice your values, but do so consistently and honestly as you do within the United States. So I think this is an area where there is a chance for the U.S. to apply its own values, take care of its legitimate concerns about security and other issues and financial controls and disclosures and whatever. At the same time, promote the kind of global free trade, foreign investment and financial flows that are good for everybody. But I think there just hasn't been enough thought given to this. And clearly Bush mishandled it in terms of his domestic politics. He should have probably paid more attention to it and worked it through the Congress and sought out people's concerns beforehand. Okay. So we have a bit of a problem.
You used the term Arab. You said that Arabs are the last group that can be kicked around in the United States. You described yourself as a Greek Christian Arab.
Greek Orthodox.
Okay. Tell us more about the diversity that there is within the Arab world.
Well, there's quite a lot of diversity in terms of ethnic groups, even racial groups, but certainly ideological, political groups, cultural groups. You have a lot of people within the Arab world who are not technically Arabs, like Armenians or Circassians or Kurds, but who make up part of the mosaic in many, especially big Arab cities, cosmopolitan cities. You have a large Christian minority in some countries, Christians in Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Palestine, Iraq. You have different other minorities. So the Arab world is much more varied than people assume it to be in the United States. There's a tremendous range of ideological views within the Arab world. There's many people in the Arab world who love what the U.S. is doing in Iraq. I wouldn't say many, but I would say maybe 5-10% of people in the Arab world are extremely happy with what the U.S. is doing in Iraq, and say so in the press, but others don't. So there is a diversity here which should be appreciated.
Just want to pursue this one more time. Again, we've been talking with Rami Khoury of the Daily Star in Beirut. To Afshin Ratansi, back to you. I think a lot of people think that all Muslims are Arabs. You described yourself as a non-Arab Muslim. Talk a little bit about diversity from your standpoint.
The cross-fertilization between all the Abrahamic religions, particularly Christianity and Islam, has a long, long history. There are, no one talks about the fact that there are Jewish MPs in Iran at the moment. I mean, this is a hugely diverse and massive civilization. But just quickly on the ports issue, I do think that if military equipment bound for Israel was to be sent from one of these ports, say New Orleans, say New York or New Jersey, if any of that was transported from a port owned by Dubai towards Israel, no doubt to kill another score of Palestinian children died at the hands of the Israeli government today, which again goes unreported, would it not be incumbent upon an Arab League member to say, these things cannot be transported from Dubai-owned ports? I think at the very least, it would be incumbent on Dubai to stop them.
Very complex issue, obviously, that we're dealing with. Ali Abu Nima, just final comment from you on this issue of diversity within the Arab and Muslim worlds. Do you think, as an Arab American, that Americans really understand that?
No, it's something I'm dealing with all the time. To make it very simple, there are more than a billion Muslims in the world, and the number of Arabs is about 250 million or 300 million approximately. The vast majority of Muslims, therefore, are not Arabs. Among Arabs, and this is where it gets a bit confusing, the vast majority of Arabs are Muslims. But within that, as Rami Khoury said, there is tremendous, tremendous diversity. There's every kind of Christian. There are Jewish Arabs. There are, of course, Muslim Arabs. There are Shiites. There are Sunni. There are, within that, a great deal of cultural, economic diversity. And it's something I wish Americans knew more about, but it's very hard to have those discussions when there is this kind of scaremongering and fear-mongering. Okay. And a last point is that, since 9/11, the United States has made it incredibly difficult for Arabs, people from Arab and Muslim countries, to come to the United States to study, to visit, to invest. People are suffering enormous delays getting visas, getting their citizenship, getting their green cards. All of this means that the human contact that's necessary to break down these barriers is being cut off. And what we need is more human contact, not less.
All right. We're going to have to leave it at that. I want to thank all of you for being with us. Ali Abu Nima, again, Palestinian-American based in Chicago, monitors media coverage of the Middle East. Afshin Ratansi in London, journalist and novelist. His novel, The Dream of the Decade, currently out. Phyllis Schlafly, the president of the Eagle Forum, thanks very much to you for being with us. And also Rami Khoury, editor-at-large of the Daily Star in Beirut. Good to have you with us. Despite some local grumbling that it's not appropriate yet, New Orleans will stage its first Mardi Gras since Katrina next Tuesday. There have already been some parades, one with an empty float, to remember 1,000 dead and 2,000 still missing. We'll get an account of what's happening in just a moment from humorist and political commentator Harry Shearer on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
We're only back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Harry Shearer is an actor. He's a political satirist. He does a lot of the voices on The Simpsons, has his own public radio program, Le Show. When he's not in Hollywood or on tour, he lives part-time in the French Quarter of New Orleans, and he's there now. Harry, always good to have you.
Thanks, Warren. How are you?
Good. We always talk about you as a humorist, and you certainly are, but a political satirist and political commentator as well. Is there very much humor in New Orleans right now?
There's an amazing amount of humor. Part of the reason I love this city is because of its community sense of humor. The first couple of parades as carnival season kicked off, the first one is a parade called Crew de Vue. The second is a dog parade called Barkus, which started as a parody of the very serious Mardi Gras parade called Bacchus. And last night was an all-female parade, well, pretty much all-female, called Muses.
They looked female anyway.
They were dressed as female. And all three of them were like watching rolling political cartoons, just devastating, raucously, bodily, nastily making fun of every person who's been involved and responsible for the screw-up that has so enveloped and devastated New Orleans. And it was a remarkable thing, especially the first night, because that parade is mule-drawn, so it's a much smaller-scale parade, to just watch. It was all locals coming out after a day of gutting their houses or arguing with insurance adjusters to share an hour and a half of one long community-wide raucous laugh at all the people who've been tormenting them for the last 5 months.
You've written in the Huffington Post in your blog there that there's a sense down there that this Mardi Gras, this one's for us.
Mm-hmm.
Explain that.
Well, you know, the argument that's made by the suit is that all about Mardi Gras' importance to the tourist economy and as the calling card to the larger tourism industry, that New Orleans is back open for business, as they say. But for people who, as I say, have been involved in just nonstop torment at the hands of insurance adjusters and utility companies and all of that, in just trying to get their lives back together, not to mention the people who still are very far away from being able to do that. It's a little breather. It's a little time to remember what's great about this city. It's a little time to remember that part of what makes this city great is its ability to surmount travail and even death, and to experience joy even in the face of that. I mean, this city's history goes back through, you know, yellow fever epidemics and all sorts of awful stuff, the whole history of the city has been written in the culture of defying death and all of this disaster and rising above it with some sort of artistic and creative expression of joy. And I think people here, now that it's upon us, you know, there are arguments about what the scale should have been and how to pay for the police overtime because no sponsors came in to do that. But I think there's a great feeling here among locals. We needed this.
Mm. Even if you're not a suit, though, you have to hope that there will be a certain number of outsiders who come in as tourists, because the city sure needs the revenue.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, carnival time or not, people should come here because an enormous number of restaurants are opened up, an enormous number of music clubs are opened up. That part of the cultural life of the city is up and running. The art galleries are open. You know, bookstores are having readings, all of that. There's great music. There's great fun. People also should come to see the other half of this city, which is much more than a half geographically and population-wise, which is the part that looks like pretty much the way it did the day that the waters receded.
Mm.
Because you don't get the full grasp of that from television or from reading about it. You really do have to come here. So I think
thing you learn from seeing it that you can't see when you're watching it on television?
I think two things. The scope, just the sheer size of the devastation, and B, the fact that it looks the way it did 5 months ago.
Hasn't changed.
So little has changed. The Army Corps of Engineers, God love them, were responsible for the removal of debris and a job done more in the breach, you should pardon the expression, than in the act.
Again, we're talking with Harry Shearer. You mentioned satire of persons involved,
mm-hmm.
and there are persons involved who are running for office right now. I presume they have been satirized, particularly the mayor.
Oh, goodness gracious, yes. The number of T-shirts, Mardi Gras floats, and other representations of fun at the expense of the mayor, particularly the Chocolate City speech, is too numerous to mention. There are at least 10 candidates running, and there's a lot of advertising up on the air and billboards around already. And the mayor has his billboard up with a photograph of himself. I don't think they quite wanted him to smile, so it's a sort of half smile, half look tough. And the slogan is "Reunite the City."
Not a time for him to look happy. Does he? Is there a chance he might be defeated? Might not even make the runoff.
I talked to the guy who's sort of the local Times-Picayune newspaper's expert on handicapping these races mm-hmm. last night, and he said his bet is the mayor makes it into the runoff against Mitch Landrieu, the lieutenant governor's brother of the current senator, Mary, and son of the former mayor. And that seems to be the smart money nowadays.
We're out of time. I wanted to ask you about the FEMA trailer, but in the parade, but I just don't have time for it. Harry Shearer, thanks a lot for being with us.
My pleasure, Warren.
Producers of To the Point, Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Katie Cooper, Jonah King, and Sherman Rimbaugh, managing producer Carmen Radziner. Special thanks to Greg Goodfellow. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. Our technical director is Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.